Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us on another day in which we have way more news to talk about than we will possibly get to. But fortunately, we have a team of pros sitting in the studio today who will help walk us through the big stories that we're looking at. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for AJC, as he always is here on Mondays. You hear him on the Friday show as well. He's the he writes a column on Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper, and he also is one of the contributors and oversees the Political Insider blog as part of Politically Georgia. Behind that AJC paywall, but it's not expensive.
No, we're cheap. I'm cheap.
$3.99.
So we've been told.
And that is Beth Shapiro. She is a former pollster, a political consultant, worked mostly with Democratic candidates. She also did a lot of work in the corporate world. She's now retired, but certainly still deeply involved in politics, as evidenced by the fact that she played a big role in Kathy Woolard's mayoral campaign. Thanks for being here today, Beth.
Glad to be here.
And Heath Garrett is back. He was gone last Monday, but we're glad to have you back, Heath, a Republican strategist and do a lot of government relations work, lobbying, as we would call it. Do you have issues down at the Capitol right now?
I don't. You know, actually, our firm does a lot of public affairs work, but I do not lobby at this current time.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize
Mostly
that.
Campaigns and public relations crisis management.
All right. As I said, we have a lot to talk about today. A little bit later in the show, we're going to look at the latest in the gun debate that's going on right now on the same day that the students down in Parkland, Florida, are going back for the first time to their school. And we'll talk about that a little later. But, Jim, I think we need to start with a story that really brings the gun debate close to home. There have been a number of companies over the last few days that have decided to sever their partnerships with the NRA. And let me just go over them very briefly. There's two moving companies, Allied and North American Van Lines, which happen to be owned by the same corporate entity, Avis Car Rental, Hertz, Alamo Enterprise, National, Chubb, which is a major insurance company, has decided they don't want to have that partnership anymore. Symantec, a cybersecurity company. And there are a number of others, and among them now, Delta Airlines.
And United.
Yes. Well, yes, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's important to get that in there,
yes,
because I think that's probably helped push Delta toward this. But that announcement came out early Saturday morning. Very unexpected, and immediately put in jeopardy a huge tax credit that it was seeking from the state legislature.
Yeah, this is the tax, the bill that would exempt Delta from paying a jet fuel tax. It's a measure they've tried to get passed in previous sessions. This time it looked like it really was going to happen. It had the support of the leadership, including Governor Deal, and now there are any number of, especially Republicans, who are really speaking out against
this.
Yeah,
it was originally added during the Great Recession when Delta, like everybody else, was having problems, and the legislature kind of wanted to do its part to save the homeboys. But it was removed in 2015 in a squabble in the House over a series of social conservative issues, immigration, religious liberty, and I'm missing one. Oh yeah, the transportation bill. Yes, it was, and so this was an attempt to put it in. Governor Deal is the main backer on it. He kind of pitched it as yet another tool to chase Amazon.com with, as saying that it would encourage Delta to open up more international things. But it is an election year, and state lawmakers were hesitant. The only way it got into this legislation was because Deal also agreed to lower the income tax rate by 0.25%.
Right. Right. Heath, Delta has tried since Saturday to staunch whatever bleeding they're feeling down at the Georgia State Capitol. They issued This statement, excuse me, Delta's decision reflects the airline's neutral status in the current national debate over gun control amid recent school shootings. Out of respect for our customers and employees on both sides, Delta has taken this action to refrain from entering this debate and focus on its business. Delta continues to support the Second Amendment. Well, people like Casey Cagle running for governor, Rick Jeffers running for lieutenant governor, they're not buying that.
Not at all. And so it's unfortunate for Delta. You can understand what they were trying to do. They were being attacked from the left all week because of their affiliation with NRA. They did make a move to put them into a neutral stance. Unfortunately, that move was moving to the left politically on the Second Amendment, and therefore they're trying to say that they're maintaining their neutral status isn't going to sell well with core Republican conservatives all over the country, particularly those who, you know, support the Second Amendment. So I understand what they're trying to do corporately there, but no question, they may want to get to neutral, but the move was not maintaining neutrality.
I think this is a very interesting moment in the life of the National Rifle Association, because up until the last few days, last week or so, it was an organization that just seemed untouchable when it comes to its power. And I think that the absolute intransigence of this organization on even discussing any type of common sense baby steps toward reforming gun laws is beginning to hurt them. That coupled with the fact that their spokespeople present such a harsh face to the organization that they're running off the kind of moderate voters, suburban voters, that Republicans need. And so I think we'll talk about the partisan implications in a minute. But I just think in general, the NRA is beginning to show some chinks in its armor. And the fact that you've got some major consumer-type corporations, the car companies, the couple of airlines now, insurance companies, saying we don't want to be associated with this organization, that's a very dramatic statement that's being made.
The timing, I think, is of this is very interesting. I mean the massacre in Parkland was on February 14th, so there was some distance. The Delta decision came on Saturday after the Thursday afternoon address by Wayne LaPierre of the NRA before CPAC.
Talk about some of the things that LaPierre said.
It was a Jeremiah of a rather disturbing kind, that in which he was tying Democrats to the to European socialism in a way that that actually had raised some eyebrows of Jewish people. You know, it sounded very 1930-ish.
Yeah.
And I think that speech may have helped push Delta toward its decision.
So here's what I think is interesting about this. I mean, there's a lot that's interesting. But you know what? Here's the difference between Delta likes to talk here about being the hometown airline and Delta, the global transportation giant. Beth, I suspect that in the larger world out there, that Jim already pointed out, United takes this move, makes this move, Delta feels they need to follow suit. So in the larger world, this is probably a positive move for Delta to make with customers in many other parts of the country. It's here that they suddenly run into blowback. It really is an interesting contrast.
I think you're right, because if Delta's hometown were Minneapolis or some city and state other than a very red state in which the NRA holds a great deal of power and in which Second Amendment believers hold a great deal of power, I don't think it would have been as big of an issue. But it's an ongoing tension for a major global entity like Delta to be able to please a worldwide customer base, but also keep the powers that be at home happy as well.
You know, this is the fifth year, I think, Heath, and you weigh in on this too. This is the fifth year where I think businesses with national or international interests based in Georgia have had a really hard time surviving the legislative session in one piece.
Yeah, there's a real schism, right, starting to develop within the Republican Party and the conservative movement. You can be conservative and still be pro-business and global business, international business, you know, broader than the borders of the state of Georgia. And some of these social issues that are also bedrock in the conservative movement. And I think this is a good example. I think you can be both pro-Second Amendment and also be a hometown supporter of Delta Airlines, which is the second largest private employer in the state of Georgia. A vast majority of the economic growth of the last 40 years has been because of companies like Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines. But for the airport and for Delta, we wouldn't have all these Fortune 500 companies located in Atlanta, Georgia. It's arguable that Delta is as important, if not more important, than the Port of Savannah, if you think about the politics and economics of the South and the region. So in Delta's defense, I will say they actually did something similar to a center-left organization just last year. So this is not the first time they've moved to neutrality, and it wasn't always at the expense of conservatives. They did this to a left organization that was sponsoring
a theater company.
The theater company that was sponsoring the
was the Public Theater in New York, one of the most prestigious legitimate theaters in New York City. They did a production of Julius Caesar that Delta was a sponsor of. And it was and their conceit in the play was to cast a Trump lookalike as Julius Caesar. And of course, in Julius Caesar, Caesar is assassinated by members of the Senate. Some people found that terribly offensive, and Delta backed away.
So they have a little credibility on making this argument. They're not choosing left or right. Actually, the governor's office just today, I think, threw Delta a little bit of a lifeline by saying that if Delta can come forward and demonstrate that they really are moving to neutrality with both leftist organizations and those viewed as on the right, that there might still be hope for salvaging the tax credit. Now, other candidates for office and other important office holders have done the opposite, but I do think that's a lifeline. If they can demonstrate this, maybe they could win back the tide here.
So, House Speaker David Ralston this morning put out a statement.
Yeah, Ralston, thank you. He said this, I am disappointed that certain corporations have chosen to engage in a sensitive debate by vilifying law-abiding supporters of Second Amendment rights. Likewise, I'm troubled that this information was not made public until after the House of Representatives passed our comprehensive tax reform measure. As we know, that bill now sits in the Senate. The Senate may amend that bill as it moves through their chamber. I trust they, along with the lieutenant governor, will carefully consider the appropriate course of action. That's an odd statement reasons.
That's an invitation.
Yeah, it's a first of all, it shows us, Beth, just how powerful the NRA grip is on our elected leaders. David Ralston is a guy who, for good reason, gets credit quite often for being the sensible adult in the room down at the state capitol. And yet, in this case, he accuses Delta of vilifying law-abiding supporters of Second Amendment rights. That's a harsh description of what Delta has done here.
Well, I think that Speaker Ralston has been a very consistent supporter of Second Amendment rights. There's no question about that. There's no question about the strength and the depth of that support. And I think just thinking strategically about what's going on at the Capitol these days is we see that there's a yet another religious liberty type of bill coming into the House, the adoption bill that just got passed on Friday. The Speaker and the House have not been as enthusiastic about those types of measures as the Senate has been. I think this also may be an attempt for the Speaker to inoculate himself a little bit should that adoption bill fail to pass the House, that he's at least standing up for one of the bedrock principles of his party.
Yeah, the other way to look at this is that what Delta's decision on Saturday really exposed House Republicans. And there are a few of them, including Ralston, who have primary opposition in May. and that it, you know, their opponent will be able to say, look at this, you voted for HB 19 and it helps Delta, and Delta's an enemy of the Second Amendment, so vote for me.
Well, you just led me into the final point I think we should discuss in terms of this Delta NRA back and forth, and that's how this will play a role in election politics. And what we might expect, is there going to be now a landslide? Are we going to see every candidate for office on the Republican side now have to rush in and condemn Delta? Let's listen to what gubernatorial candidate and state senator Michael Williams said on the floor about this.
This bill is being held up by Delta, by big corporations. Now, whether or not you like Delta and what they said about the NRA this past week is irregardless to me. The fact that a large corporation here in this state can say the citizens of Georgia are not going to get their full tax rebate because they want their own tax credit, that is a shame. We should not allow Delta or any other corporation to do that to us. We need to take a stand today as the Senate. Send a message to them that we are going to do what is best for all of Georgians, not just big corporate.
So, Jim, with a Michael Williams running for governor, with a Casey Cagle running for governor, Josh McCoon for Secretary of State, David Schiff, we can go down the list of Republicans running for statewide office. Is this thing going to snowball in such a way that Delta is likely to lose this tax break?
It's already lost it.
All right, it's gone.
There will be a Senate Finance Committee meeting on Wednesday, and it will be removed, and the Senate will approve the general tax bill.
You know, and I think that the governor's office did throw a lifeline out there to give it one last chance. I think what's difficult but possible is that some cooler heads, including the speakers and the lieutenant governors and the governor, can get together and help people bifurcate the issues, right? Senator Williams in distant last place in the governor's race, so let's not assign him to all Republicans, but in distant last place, he did say, regardless of this bill, I think that you can be pro-Second Amendment, you can be upset at Delta about what they've done, you can work with them on fighting that, but at the same point in time, recognize the tax credit actually helps Delta create jobs, which is what the Republican Party and the conservative movement has really always been about, economic growth and prosperity. And so I don't think those things have to be mutually exclusive. The question is, can we reduce the emotion and time?
Well, all right, but let me just offer the other side of that, which some members of the legislature are making without regard to the decision on NRA. Jim pointed out that the fuel tax was first proposed back in the recession. Delta has now got record profits. They're no longer hurting the way they were in 2007, 2008. So there, Beth, there truly is a legitimate argument separate from the NRA as to whether or not that fuel tax break is in fact really necessary at this point. I don't know whether it is or not, but it isn't as if Delta isn't thriving right now.
That's true, and I think certainly the Clayton County legislative delegation is making that argument because they stand to take a serious financial hit in loss of sales tax income from the purchase of fuel.
All right, let's do this. I'd love to take a break. We're going to come back to the guns issue a little bit later in the show because there's a lot to talk about. But let's get a break out of the way, and when we come back, let's talk about the president at CPAC on Friday. We didn't have a chance on Friday's show to break this down, but he was in full-throated campaign mode, and there are many people who were terribly distressed and others who were thrilled by his return to the rhetoric demonizing undocumented. So let's talk about that when we come back. This is Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, the president at CPAC, as I said, this was this was campaign rally all over again. He at one point said, well, they wrote me a speech, but you wouldn't mind, would you, if I divert from that and just talk? And the audience, of course, went crazy with excitement. And boy, did he ever go off script.
Yeah, it was 2016 all over again.
Yeah.
It was October 2016.
Yeah, but among those things were he returned to his full-throated condemnation of undocumented immigrants without regard to whether they were visa lottery people, whether they were DACA. It was just that painting with a broad brush, as he did in that infamous campaign announcement at Trump Tower. And among the things he did was to quote from a song, which he did occasionally on the campaign trail, called The Snake, which essentially equated all undocumented workers to poisonous snakes who, if you let them into your home, they will bite you and kill you.
And if you bring them into your bosom, it's Cleopatra all over again, you know? I will tell you what, it is moments like this that I'm sure have members in the Senate, like Johnny Isaacson, wondering how much stock they can put in whatever comes out of the president's mouth vis-a-vis immigration. This is also the same guy who said he wanted a bill of love to solve the immigration problem. He wanted to sign anything that Congress put in front of him on immigration.
And he complicates every major issue that he steps into. We've got serious people in the U.S. Senate, including our own Senator Isaacson, who are working diligently to find some common ground on this issue of the issue of the Dreamers, of the DACA young people, as well as the security measures that are needed to make our country our borders more secure. And on the one hand, you've got serious folks engaging in real policy conversations, and then you have the campaigner in chief who has to go out and, I guess, get his jollies by being cheered by making the most outrageous statements that he can. And I think Jim's exactly right. It's impossible for Republicans in the Senate and the House, and the Republicans in particular, to really know what they can get through, because they don't know what this president will go out and campaign on, regardless of what they can get through the legislature, through the Congress.
It continues to be a fascinating issue for all of us on the conservative side of trying to advance liberty when you look at the president and his comments, because, as we like to say, don't pay attention necessarily to what he's saying, but what he's doing. And so in his mind, right, if I were trying to defend him, it'd be that he doesn't see anything inconsistent with pointing out there are a lot of bad people coming across the border trying to do bad things in the United States of America. Drug cartels, terrorists, all the above are actually happening. But at the same point in time, he's gone further on immigration than any other Republican has been willing to go, by saying he wants to increase the number of Dreamers who are actually protected under legislation, and given the U.S. Senate Republicans and House covered a lot of cover. So if you look at purely his actions, which is about the only thing you can do to maintain some level of intellectual sanity maybe in the modern era, you can absolutely see that he is trying to advance the ball. And the question is, how does this affect the negotiations in the Senate? And we'll have to see, because I think by this time tomorrow we'll be talking about something else.
How do we say? Well, Jim.
Well, here. Oops.
Go ahead.
I think I've lost. Have I lost my radio?
You're there.
Okay. All right. I can't hear. There we go. I can hear myself now. What I was going to say is that Isaacson was part of the bipartisan issue that put this together, this immigration bill package that came the closest of passing the U.S. Senate. I don't know how far it would have gotten into the House, but it collapsed on the remarks of Donald Trump, because the president signaled that he would not have the backs of Republican senators who took the risk.
I want to weigh in, though, for a second, Heath. I think when you say that he's been willing to go further than any other Republican, I assume what you're talking about is the current makeup of Congress and other GOP leaders. Certainly George W. Bush, as president, wanted very much to pass a comprehensive immigration reform measure and came incredibly close, and it collapsed in the long run. But certainly, maybe in current terms. And Beth, I'd ask you to respond to Heath, because if actions matter, which actions of the president's do we take to be the actions that do matter? When he says, it's an act of love to protect the Dreamers, but then refuses to support the bipartisan measure that Isaacson and others, I'm not sure which actions even
it's
we're supposed to pay attention to.
It's absolutely impossible to determine what action to pay attention to. I don't usually feel sorry for Republicans, but in this case, I do feel sorry for the members of the House and Senate who are trying to forge consensus on any issue. But right now, immigration is the one that's bedeviling all of them. It's because the president has no interest in policy. He puts no effort into learning policy, the nuances of policy. He just shoots from the hip and says whatever is on his mind. When we get back to guns, we can talk about some of the things that he's talking about there. So it's just impossible to have a serious policy conversation when you've got him in the White House.
So let's pick up on a couple of things that are going as part of all this. I mean, number one, we should point out that March 5th was supposed to be the deadline after which DACA young people were no longer protected. But there is a case working its way through appeals right now in federal courts, which questions whether or not DACA was legal to begin with. And so that's still in court. The Trump administration went to the Supreme Court and filed a brief saying, we want you to supersede all the lower courts and give us a ruling or a chance to be heard right now on whether or not DACA is legal or not legal. Just today, the breaking news is the Supreme Court unanimously refused, which means it's still in the lower courts, and which also means that the March 5th deadline is no longer of a concern to those DACA recipients.
Yeah. You have two federal judges who said negated the March 5th deadline.
Yeah, right. And the Supreme Court refused to take that up. So, I mean, that—
And interestingly, that may have helped Donald Trump, because he was going to be in the position of having to make a decision, right, and possibly extend— while the negotiations continue.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. So I want to, as a Chicagoan, and I talk about this, I talk about Chicago. I'm proud to have grown up there and been a Chicagoan for so many years. The song The Snake, which President Trump likes to quote from, was written by a wonderful jazz singer, songwriter, musician named Oscar Brown Jr. Oscar Brown Jr. was African-American, grew up on the south side of Chicago, was a friend of people like Lorraine Hansberry and other great African-Americans in Chicago. And he was a firm believer in social justice and civil rights. He worked for those things for his entire career. Now, when you actually listen to The Snake, which Trump recited, I suspect that looking at it through the lens of today, Beth, we might think it sounds like, and even Oscar Brown might look at it and say, I wonder if this song is sexist, because it talks about a young woman who, you know, well, you should have known I was a snake. What the hell is wrong with you is what the song says. So maybe that would have been a problem. Nevertheless, Oscar Brown Jr.'s daughters, grown daughters, are out now on the circuit, and they're responding to the fact that Trump has been using this to demonize immigrants.
He's stealing. Oscar Brown Jr. wrote those lyrics.
And Oscar Brown Jr. wrote The Snake.
And he's stealing, and then he's twisting Oscar's meaning to serve his own campaign and climate of intolerance and hate, which is the opposite of what the original author, Oscar Brown Jr., intended.
He's perversely using The Snake to demonize immigrants.
Yes.
My father never stood against immigrants.
Never.
He did several albums with people all around the world.
Oscar Brown Jr.'s daughters. Jim, all this at a time when we read on the front page of your newspaper today that the family of Julio Garrido, a Cuban immigrant who was picked up by ICE and was in the detention center in South Georgia, the Stewart Detention Center, died of pneumonia. There's are questions as to whether he got proper treatment by ICE doctors.
Family is saying no, he didn't.
And then there are two other cases of deaths in federal custody in Georgia facilities. And so this whole situation just is, it doesn't matter which side of this you're on. It's just one complication and one sad story after another.
Involving millions of people.
Yeah.
You know, the complexity of this issue is almost beyond the capability of what I call the Wild West of politics and social media today. The country is so divided. Chuck Todd did a good thing on his Sunday show yesterday and showed how social media and the algorithms drive people who are left of center to blogs and only news that feeds their view of the world, and that it takes folks with right of center and drives them all to news and blogs of their view of the world. And we've really become extremely divided. And so solving these kind of complex issues, comprehensive immigration reform, comprehensive, you know, discussions about everything, tax policy and all this, but immigration, it does. It affects tens of millions of people in the country and their families, and nobody has a solution for how we get back to an ability to have saner heads prevail.
I agree completely with Heath, and I think that it's even more difficult to envision getting back to a point where saner heads prevail because we have a head of the country that some of us feel doesn't quite qualify for the term sane. And when you have somebody who is making no attempt at all to try to find common ground or at least tone down his rhetoric, then it's very challenging to see how people on the right on immigration don't remain riled up and people on the left don't remain riled up in response to what's going on. It's a very challenging time for those of us who try to find paths down the middle.
I need to take us back to the Delta NRA thing. I'm looking at a tweet that Casey Cagle put out at just as we went on the air, Bill. It says, "I will kill any tax legislation that benefits at Delta unless the company changes its position and fully reinstates its relationship with the NRA."
Well, there you go. And I'm glad you mentioned that. And to take us back just for a moment, because this also takes us back to the David Ralston statement in which he essentially invited the lieutenant governor to, in fact, do something about that tax break. So that's it again for Delta and its tax break this year. Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way, and we'll come back with still so much to talk about guns, some things happening in the legislature. But as we go, I thought maybe we should listen just a little to Oscar Brown Jr., because he was such a great fighter for social justice. And so we're going to give you about 30 seconds as we go to break of Oscar Brown Jr. singing one of his most famous songs, which is probably his strongest statement about his feelings about what the world needs to become. This is a song called Brown Baby.
Brown baby, brown baby, it makes me glad that you will have things I have never of men's hearts, all the hate is hurled. You're gonna live in a better world.
On the next Fresh Air, cartoonist and essayist Tim Kreider. In his new collection of personal essays, he writes about riding a circus train to Mexico with a friend, pretending to be her husband, having a whirlwind romance with a performance artist and prostitute, and about his beloved cat, who turned him into someone who believes
a man without a cat is not a man.
Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Stellar panel in the Political Rewind studio today. Republican Heath Garrett, Democrat Beth Shapiro, journalist Jim Galloway. Jim, one of the most interesting stories in the Atlanta Constitution this morning, front page story, Russian trolls targeted Georgia in fake tweets. And it turns out, because your people did some research, that there were thousands of tweets aimed at us here in the state of Georgia to whip us into a frenzy one way or the other over any number of issues.
Right, right. A lot on Donald Trump. It looks like John Lewis was a big target.
Yeah.
The tweets linked his name with phrases like racial fomenter of trouble, and they took great pains to make it look like they were here. I mean, there was even one tweet that says that the kind of linked to a story about how to care for your pets on 4th of July during 4th of yes. July fireworks,
and it was a local TV news story.
Yeah, I will tell you, it's kind of spooky.
Well, it is. There were tweets, Beth, referring to the a conspiracy to murder Dr. King by federal agents working in cooperation with people in King's inner circle. There were tweets that amplified one of Representative Hank Johnson's probably lower moments when he made a disparaging remark about Jewish West Bank settlers. But we were manipulated here in this state by these Russian trolls.
Well, I think that now that we know what people are trying to do, what the Russians are trying to do through our social media, then I think it's incumbent on us to be better educated consumers of social media. It doesn't happen often, but every once in a while I'll see a Facebook post from a friend of mine who's reposting or sharing something from an organization that I've never heard of and of dubious. The name just sounds kind of odd, and I'll Google that, and the organization doesn't exist, or it's been shown to be something other than what it purports to be. And so I think all of us need to take a moment before we get outraged over what we see on social media, and before we hit the share button on it, to take a minute and if it's something that's making you really mad, whether you're on the right or on the left, take a minute and figure out where is it coming from before I start to believe it and get myself in a turmoil over it. I just think that we can be better consumers of the stuff that comes in front of us.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. I think one of the things in the context of this story that keeps getting, and it's tucked away in a small paragraph in about the middle of the article, but what the investigations in Washington have found actually is that the Russians set about to destabilize American politics long before it was even evident that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. They were involved in trying to destabilize the Democratic primary on behalf of Bernie Sanders. They were involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, promoting racial kind of hatred in reverse to foment hatred among African Americans, and obviously doing that with some conservative white populations as well. So I think that we've got to really do is on this story get back to the full context of they obviously got involved heavily for Donald Trump, but at the same point in time were doing this on the left and the right. I think we've got to really treat this as a national security issue, one that's not partisan, and I think that's part of the detriment of the story.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point that they were out to cause trouble on both sides. And it was all about just fomenting a division in our country.
Oh, yeah. We have a phrase for it. It's let's you and him fight.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Heath, the question is, are we going to see this in 2018? Are we going to see it in 2020 when we have a president who refuses to acknowledge that Russia did, in fact, interfere and attempt to manipulate Americans? Is there anything that's going to stop it from happening again?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know that we are set up as a nation right now to do anything about this. I refer to this the social media phenomenon as the Wild Wild West, right? In the sense that these companies have amassed huge amount of power and influence over the forms of media that individuals see in this country. The algorithms are what they are, and it's very easy to mask yourself in aliases that allow you to negatively influence folks. This has been going going on, by the way, in politics for hundreds of years in other ways, slick sheets and other forms of media. It just wasn't quite as powerful and as deceptive.
Well,
and
it wasn't,
such grand
it wasn't a foreign government.
Well, and actually, you know, there's a lot of evidence that nobody covered this because everybody was so in love with President Obama, but the Chinese interfered in the 2008 election on behalf of Barack Obama. And so we do have a large and long history of foreign governments doing this. We need to take this more seriously because it's not just about elections. It's corporate espionage and all the above.
All right. Let's move on. The students at Douglas High School are heading back today for the first day since the shootings on Valentine's Day. We know now that the building in which the massacre took place is going to be torn down. They're probably going to turn it into a memorial of some kind. Jim, you know, the president seems to have spoken in many ways from his heart on this. When you watch him, I think it's fairly clear that I know people say he doesn't have empathy and that sort of thing, and that there we've seen examples that he doesn't. But on this issue, he does seem to have truly been moved. He claims he's really wants action, but the House is in session for one day, I think, this week. I don't know how much we're going to see get done.
No, I don't think you're going to see much action. And again, I mean, we can point to what Beth was saying just a few minutes ago. I mean, he has spoken in many. On many sides of this issue. I mean, he's indicated that he'd be willing to have a mandatory purchase age of 21 and older, and which would in direct opposition to the NRA. On the other hand, he has also kind of sided with the NRA when it says that what the solution to this is hardening schools, arming teachers.
Yeah. Yeah. He told the governors who were meeting, Beth, today that he's not afraid of the NRA. They every now and then they have to go up against the NRA. They should be willing to go up against the NRA. Well, that remains to be seen.
You know, I think there are three certainties in life: death, taxes, and the NRA will not ever move anywhere from its extreme positions on common sense gun regulation. And so I think that for us to think we're going to change things legislatively right now at this point in the year, I think is wishful thinking. And I think that people who really want to change how we treat guns and the regulation of guns need to change the players. And the only time, to my mind, the only way we're going to start to see meaningful reform is if we start to elect people who are not Republicans to office, because the Republican Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of the National Rifle Association.
But almost everyone who has appeared on the show since the shooting has said this does feel different. There does feel like perhaps we've reached some sort of tipping point, evidenced by the corporations that have severed their partnerships with NRA. Tom Faust, our producer, pointed out something interesting. He pointed out that Emma Gonzalez, who has been one of the student activists leading this effort down there against guns and against the NRA, she now has more Twitter followers, 950,000, than does Dana Loesch of the NRA. I mean, this does feel... It may not happen in this Congress right now. It may be that Beth's right. We'll see this come up as an election issue, but it does feel different, Heath.
I don't want to be the contrarian. However, I feel like we have the same conversation after every mass shooting. I do think that where the kind of general public is in the short term, it does feel slightly more emotional about this. However, I do think that one of the reasons is because the NRA may be correct on some of its policy, but it has not handled this crisis in a smart way, both politically and from a PR standpoint, in my opinion. And we're concentrating solely on the Second Amendment issues as if the NRA is everybody who thinks about this. And I think that's way too limiting. They do have 5 million members. They are powerful. But the belief in the Second Amendment and whether or not there are a lot of people who are willing to talk about some sensible regulations on background checks and other things, but to fundamentally believe we're not discussing or debating things that would actually make a difference in these shootings. We're not discussing culture. We're not discussing video games. We're not discussing mental health issues. And if that were on the table, I think you could bring people to the table.
I said this Friday, and I'll say it again. I think, to me, I will think that something is different is afoot if I see Rick Scott's agenda passed by the Florida legislature.
He has now said he wants to raise the age of gun ownership to 21 from 18 in the state of Florida, the first Republican governor that I'm aware of who has decided to completely break from NRA on that issue, and he's proposed a couple of other changes.
Opposes arming teachers.
Right.
So I agree with Jim. If those passed a Republican-controlled legislature, then yes, I would agree that something has shifted. I tend to agree with Heath that we go through the same conversation, we go through the outrage, and then something new comes along, which is why I think that it'll be instructive to see what happens in November in Georgia and in other places around the country.
Meanwhile, we continue to have this atmosphere of hostility, of hatred. You know, Eric Erickson, our friend over at WSB at AM 750, who, you know, he's often been a much more thoughtful and certainly has his own brain when it comes to Republican and conservative values. And we've often said, well, he's got some interesting thoughts. He has written a piece, though, now, where he's labeling David Hogg, who's the young man at the school who's been really one of the leading spokespeople for moving toward gun control issue efforts. He's calling him a bully. He's using his position to bully others. This is a young man who actually lived through this shooting spree, this massacre. And Eric says if he cannot hold all the people who screwed up accountable because of his agenda, and he accuses anyone who disagrees with him of hatred, he is not someone any of us should pay attention to. He says that Hogg has been a bully toward the NRA, David Loesch, and others. We've had people on this show. I mean, last week, we had two panelists, Republicans, saying, oh, these students, why are they speaking out? If I were a mom, I wouldn't let my students speak out. What is happening to us?
Well, I think it goes back to the lack of civil discourse, you know, in the country, whether that started with 24-hour cable news has obviously been expanded by social media. I do believe, and I counsel all of our Republican clients, that we don't have to refrain. We can refrain from ad hominem attacks, attacking individuals. Never in a situation like this would you attack a victim if you want to get your message across effectively. I like to say we have the Constitution and we have principles and policy and facts on our side. Let's stick to those arguments, and we're going to prevail most of the time, I think, in the public domain. I think this is really hurting kind of the Second Amendment cause and the greater conservative cause overall by attacking these types.
Thank you. I'm going to move on if I can. We got a couple other things I really want to get in. Jim, the religious liberty bill, which is the one that would say that a religious organization that does adoptions doesn't have to adopt to gay and lesbian couples. It passed the Senate very easily, 35-19. It goes to the House now. And interestingly, a producer of the Michael J. Fox Show, Community, and other TV shows who does work on location here in Georgia tweeted out to my fellow showrunners, if this dumb bill becomes law, let's be done filming television shows in Georgia. Well, two things I believe, and I get your much more informed response, Jim, are not going to happen. One, the film production industry is not shutting down in Georgia anytime soon. They may be disturbed by this kind of issue. And two, this bill's not going to pass in the House, is it? Oh, you think it is?
I wouldn't bet against it.
Really?
This is an election year. It's been separated from the adoption bill, the HB 159, that was a complete rewrite. And that was if you went back and you listened to the Governor Deals and Speaker Ralston's objections, it was the fact that this provision was mucking up their bill. that they objected to more so than anything else. I think it's entirely, this is a Republican House that's dealing with this bill right now, and I think
will the governor sign it?
I think number one, I think Ralston is under a great deal of pressure to allow it to move, and if the governor, well, here's the thing.
I mean, Governor Deal can't run for office again. What the heck? Why not?
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, even if it passes the House and the governor vetoes it. He will veto it in the final days of his term, and we will have a new governor next year. And if he's a Republican, then he would sign such a bill, I think.
I think it's important to note that this is a solution in search of a problem. The unfortunate reality is that Georgia does not have any type of statewide protection against discrimination against LGBT Georgians. And so any adoption agency, religious or otherwise, can discriminate against an LGBT family because it's legal to do so. So there's no reason to even have this bill. And the second thing I would point out is that the stated concern is that it will enable more kids to be adopted. And I don't quite understand the logic behind, if we take a group of people off the table and say, no, you can't adopt, how does that then expand the pool of families that can adopt? So,
well, my jaw dropped when you said that this thing would could very easily pass.
You don't, right. Don't give it. We'll watch it. It's something worth. The one thing I would add to what Beth said was, you know, Elena Parent in the Senate brought something up very interesting. She says, okay, what does this do if you're an LGBT kid looking for parents? What does this for you?
All right. Well, we're going to watch that. We have almost no time left, except to say, Heath, you're from up in this neck of the woods. We now know that John Ossoff isn't going to run again for the 6th District congressional seat. There are a couple of Democrats in that race. Is Karen Handel safe moving forward?
I absolutely think so. I mean, John's not running because it defaults back in a general election type scenario to its typically much more conservative, Republican-oriented demographics. Now, in this environment, could you make a better run than you could in the past? Maybe off of the anti-Trump movement in the Democratic Party, but Karen Handel's safe for now.
Beth, you got about 20 seconds. Are you hopeful about the 6th?
I think that I would tend to agree with Heath. I think what's in Representative Handel's favor is that she's a woman, and she also will probably not have had any votes on any type of gun legislation prior to November, which will help her among moderate voters. But the thing I would watch, though, is that encompassed within this district is I think it's the 40th Senate seat. Senator Fran Millar is the incumbent. He's facing a very strong challenge from former Representative Sally Harrell. And my impression is she's putting together a very strong grassroots campaign. So if there are legislative races like that within the 6th that are bringing out more Democrats than expected, then it's possible that a Democrat could take the 6th.
Very quick word, speaking of people running, Brooks Coleman, 26-year veteran Republican from Gwinnett County, announced that he is not going to seek re-election. And Alan Peek in Macon on Friday said he's not seeking re-election.
Yeah, and Coleman is the second House member, House Republican from Gwinnett County, who is giving it up.
Yep, we're going to watch that because there are some interesting possibilities for Democrats, particularly up that way. All right, we're completely out of time for today's show. Beth Shapiro, Heath Garrett, Jim Galloway, thanks for a great discussion. By the way, we are live at the Capitol on Wednesday. It's crossover day. Jim will be with us. So will Greg Bluestein, Teresa Tomlinson, mayor of Columbus, Jackie Gingrich Cushman will be with us. And we've got a number of Republican and Democratic legislative leaders lined up to stop by on the day that bills either go through or they're dead. So we'll see you Wednesday at 2 for another Political Rewind.